and it was, but it was just incredible. And we started up in Turkey, in Istanbul, and made our way down through Turkey, down into Syria, across into Lebanon, and then kept going into Jordan and finished up in Egypt. And it was incredible time. It's my first time in the Middle East, and loved everything about it, the landscapes, the ancient sites, the people, the food, everything. But there was this one particular day. We were a couple of weeks into the tour, and it was a really hot day. From memory, it was about nearly 40 degrees. And so we had, as you do on a lot of tours, you have some rest days, and then they have some, you know, optional extras. You can do an additional tour of something if you like. And this particular optional extra was about 3.5 hours drive, I think, from memory. And being so hot, there was a number of us who decided, out of the group of 12, I think only four decided to go. The rest of us were like, we need this rest day. It's too hot to do it. And so we didn't go. And so the site that we could have visited that day was the ancient city of Palmyra in central Syria. And then, of course, we couldn't believe it. A couple of years, 18 months later, the war started, and we couldn't believe that this beautiful, safe, friendly, incredible place that we had wandered the streets at night without any fear, and just an incredible country, was the same country that was now at war. And then, of course, in 2015, Palmyra was partially destroyed during the war. And so we certainly wish that we had bothered to make the trip that day. And now it's 2019, and it looks like Syria are going to, they're beginning to see tourists return to the country. And even the city of Palmyra is right now under renovations and is due to reopen to tourists very shortly. But it got me thinking because, as I said before, I've noticed a trend with some of my friends on their travels. Our friends travelling to the Great Barrier Reef to see it before it's gone. And another friend who's travelling to New Zealand to see the glaciers before they're gone. Another friend travelling to the Pacific Islands to see them before they're gone. And so we know that these are natural wonders that can't be restored. They can't be brought back to their former glory. They will only be immortalised in our history books. And so we know that it's a time of lasts on planet Earth. And, of course, many of you would be very aware, in 2018, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change told us that we have about 12 years to limit that catastrophic, irreversible changes to our climate. And, of course, we know it would be so easy to argue that we are already experiencing that catastrophic change. The thing is, the news was actually quite stunning to me. As an optimistic greenie, if you like, I'd always assumed that technology and the goodwill of all the people was going to put things right. And I just wasn't paying close enough attention. And we could see the delegates at that final plenary in South Korea. They stood around hugging each other, these climate scientists, not knowing what else to do, crying, anxiety, fear, and the grief that they were feeling within that community. And then something happened that hadn't really bothered me much until then. Fellow Christians and conservative family members around me started stating very firmly, I don't believe in climate change. Wow, is all I can say. So these are people who adamantly believe that Noah put a zoo on a boat, but couldn't believe thousands of climate scientists from 195 countries were saying that things didn't look good for the planet. And so the problem is that we are facing that climate catastrophe, as we've already spoken about and some of you have shared so succinctly this morning. And I'm sure there would still perhaps be varying opinions across the room on this subject. But I'm sure what we also have something in common there, and that is that rising uncertainty as to the future of our planet. That rising uncertainty for our children, rising concern for the increased suffering around the world due to these changes. And in essence, it's the biblical story that reveals humanity as being created to be co-workers with God in stewarding the earth. So for those of us who identify as followers of Christ, that stewardship, that management of the earth becomes something that we should be concerned about, no matter what our stance. And the issue is, as we look around, the vast majority of humanity, Christian or not, has very little concern for the sickness of our planet and what's going on right now. And alongside that uncertainty can be the fear and anxiety that I've heard some of you already describe this morning around a number of those issues. And some of those issues could be apprehension around personal safety, future loss of wealth, the anticipation that life is going to get more difficult, uncertainties around food security and political instability that may happen in the future. And for some, those fears crystallise around imagining that more harsh and difficult world for our children and our grandchildren. For others, that question around, do we even have a future that looks anything like it does now? How will society as a whole hold up to this? So with the dangers of climate change taking those many forms, there's certainly that fear of the unknown that leads to that anxiety and grief in some cases. So sometimes that fear also morphs into that anger, as we spoke about before, the disparity between the rich and the poor as this climate changes, and of course the privileged exacerbating the problem and the poor bearing that brunt of the greedy decision makers. But of course, as Peter mentioned, we also become angry at ourselves. It's not easy on the heart, but we have to still locate ourselves in this problem because we are part of that rich 1%. And of course, this problem is, after all, it is a byproduct of success, the problem we're quite currently facing. The problem is a byproduct of our success, if you will. And Alain de Botton, I don't know if I've said that correctly, but he said, generals who blow up bombs know they want to kill people. Chief executives who manage lorries transporting milk from depots to supermarkets generally have no motives more sinister than the wish to make some money for their shareholders. When we use ample water to brush our teeth or fly to Florence to see some Titian paintings, aggression is so far from our minds. However, we are daily reminded that innocent quotidian actions have a cumulative destructive potential greater than the A-bomb. We have been asked to reconceive of ourselves as unthinking killers. And so what's our response to that? As people who follow Christ, what's our response to this particular idea of reconceiving ourselves as unthinking killers? And I don't know about you, but as Claire mentioned, sometimes we're like Jonah. When we're tasked with warning the people of Nineveh about their imminent destruction or doing something about it ourselves, he just runs away from God. He falls asleep even while those stormy waters are raging around him. He dissociates from those overwhelming feelings. And sometimes those feelings of uncertainty and anxiety can turn into grief, become an experience of grief. And for those of us who take seriously our call to care for creation, our call to steward the earth, our call to see that there is a future and a hope for future generations, it looks really heartbreaking. We might feel a grief that's hard to define, hard to nail down. It's an unresolved or an unquantifiable loss, if you like, unsolidified. It's ambiguous in its nature, because it's the loss of something that you hoped to have or experience, or the loss of something that we have not quite yet lost. And in a sense, that non-linear character of climate change is in some ways an appropriate metaphor for our non-linear response to it as well. We know the damage is done. We know there are limits to the amount of time we have left before even more cataclysmic damage is done. But the damage shows up in delayed and unpredictable increments. We didn't know that the bushfires would happen this season. They might not have happened for another 5 or 10 years. But I really do believe it's helpful for us to name some of those things that we are experiencing. It helps. And so I wanted just to note a few things that we might be experiencing, and you will probably resonate with some of these and then have others of your own. The first thing I've noticed here is the things that we love that we potentially may lose. So this breakdown of the climate, this degradation of our environment means that there are many things that we could lose. Coastlines, plants and animals on the verge of extinction, the Pacific Islands. So our way of life, it can't be sustained. We can't keep doing what we're doing, and our lives are going to look extremely different in the next decade. The second thing that we may need to name is how we feel about the suffering of creation, as John showed those pictures. And these can be really concrete: the rubbish dumps, the landfill sites, those islands of plastic in the oceans which are causing sea life to suffer. And then we've got the cruel and inhumane treatment of creatures, other living creatures, to increase profit margins, the root of the cause, the greed that we see on planet Earth, or our own wildlife suffering this bushfire season. The next thing is what we expected that might not be. Disappointments in our expectations for the future. Whatever we do to limit further harm on the planet, our world, the world that we leave future generations is going to be so different. It's probably going to be much harder. It's going to be less secure. We may be fearful of what the future holds. The next thing is the sorrows of the world. Refugees, many of whom are already climate refugees. Global inequality and poverty. We're going to be able to buy our way out of some of the coming changes in the next probably decade or two, but others don't have that luxury. Hearts aching for farmers in India or Cambodia who are already experiencing catastrophic changes in their livelihoods. So the sorrows of the world can be numerous, and we can find ourselves overwhelmed by them. The next one is ancestral grief, because some of us may carry some injustices that have been done to our forefathers, but then others of us bear the burdens of inherited privilege gained through the exploitation of others. And it may be that we grieve to a degree the history of our own families, our own ancestors, knowing how those stories are part of how we got to this point. Our own upbringing, our own ways of consuming is a part of how we got to this point. And the final one there is just the harm that we've caused, acknowledging how the way we live our lives is damaging creation. And so that's sorrow for our part in global crisis, that sorrow for being a part of the 1%. But at this point, it's really important to remind ourselves that grief is good, and grief is necessary. It's part of the human processes. And so when we really sit with what is happening, grief is an entirely appropriate human response. But in this case of climate grief, I really believe that there is only one option, one response to it. And so we'll just unpack that a little bit now, but that response is one of action, that we would refuse to be paralysed by this grief, that we would understand that our choice is this: we can either let it constrict our heart, and that despair can do that, or we can let it open us up to the plight of our neighbour, to the plight of creation. And that's the choice that we have to make when we're faced with this grief around climate catastrophe. So earlier we read from Isaiah 58, and I want to just reread very quickly verses, the second half of verse 9 up to verse 12. If you remove the yoke from among you, the pointing of the finger, the speaking of evil, if you offer food to the hungry and satisfy the needs of the afflicted, then your light shall rise in the darkness, and your gloom will be like the noonday. The Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your needs in parched places and make your bones strong. And you shall be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters never fail. Your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt. You shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairers of the breach, the restorers of streets to live in. So you might have heard of this scripture before, especially from the perspective of the centrality of justice in the lives of people who claim to worship God. And I believe that these particular verses are also central as we grapple with the ethics of our response to the ecological crisis and what that means for us. So there's a number of word pictures that draw our attention there to the connection to the earth and to the fact that we draw our nourishment from the earth. And the writer of these words, he was trying to get across one of the important jobs of the prophets was to help people to make sense out of bad things that were happening and to call them in that moment to faithfulness to God. So the writer supposed that if a person was faithful to Yahweh, that even in the midst of that darkness, even in the midst of that despair or grief, they could respond with care. They could respond to the poor, they could respond to the oppressed, and they could respond to all that society rejects and avoids. And so we need to remember here that the whole of Isaiah is really the period of the Assyrian and the Babylonian exile. And this particular chapter, it was written to the community of Jerusalem after they had returned home. So they'd been in exile and they'd returned home. And the people were in the middle of economic depression. They were trying to resettle themselves. They were trying to rebuild their community. And families were broken and relationships were fractured. This was not a whole and healthy community. This was a community in grief. The Israelites were refugees returning to their homes, unsure about their future. They were really even unsure about their ability to survive. They were a grieving people in this moment. And yet, even in this context, even in this moment, God calls them to look up and to look out. That the very act of looking up and looking out, the very act of caring for the afflicted and the exploited, would be a vehicle of their healing. And so, just like people in grief and returning from exile, we also need to choose to look up and to look out. We need to choose that action that can become an antidote to despair. You know, there's a Jewish midrash, which is kind of like an ancient commentary on the scriptures, and it talks about the Israelites finding themselves as they stand at the shore of the Red Sea, or the Sea of Reeds, as the Jewish people call it. And the midrash explains the thoughts of the Israelites in that particular moment, saying, what do we do? Do we fight? Do we just jump into the sea and die by suicide? And supposing all these things. But then Moses tells the people in Exodus 14, verse 13, don't fear, God will save you. But then God speaks up and he says to Moses in verse 15, he says, why are you crying out to me? Tell the Israelites to get moving. And indeed, that is really where we are right now. We move forward. We move forward into the rising sea waters. For the Israelites, a future opened up that they did not know was possible. And for us, we can't possibly know the future, only that we can't go back, only that we have to keep moving forward, only that action is the antidote to grief and despair. So we can make the commitment to action, to not give up, for so many reasons. There are many reasons that we can hope in the middle of our grief and anxiety. And I've just got a few here. I'd love for you to add your own again to this list. But these are some of the reasons that we must not give up, that we must move, that we must act, that we can go forward as the Israelites were called to go forward. Firstly, because we're not doomed. As long as we act. In a world which we do everything we can to restrain climate change, it's barely going to resemble the one in which we do nothing. So we're not going to like the first world, but the problem is we won't survive in the second. So we're not doomed as long as we act. Another reason is because, I don't know about you, but I don't want to be the kind of person I want to be the person, kind of person, sorry, who doesn't give up on important jobs. You don't do what's right because you think it might get you something. You do what's right because it's right. Because that's what integrity is, doing what you believe in, even if it's not going to save the world. Because we don't want to walk away from the hurting world any more than we'd walk away from our mothers or our grandmothers as they grow frail and as they grow old. I love my grandmother, who's 96 years old, and and really cannot remember more than about 10 seconds previously. But we have a duty. We have a calling to our relatives, to our mothers and our grandmothers and our fathers and our grandfathers and those that are ailing, those that are frail. And we have that same duty, a calling to our ailing earth, to our frail planet. Another one, because we promise our children, we promise them that we love them, we promise them that we would keep them safe, we promise them that we would do everything in our power to give them the world. And we didn't mean that we would give them whatever is left and scattered and torn at the table after this great big cosmic going out of business sale. We don't give up because everybody knows what we have to do. The answers are actually already there. It isn't as though the world is waiting for some technological breakthrough or divine revelation. We actually just need to stop setting carbon on fire and put those things in place, and things can be different. We don't give up because climate change is unjust. It threatens. It's the greatest violation of human rights the world has ever seen. And injustice is cowardly and fragile. And so it crumbles when people stand up for what is right. We don't give up because, I don't know about you, I don't want to be a free rider. I don't want to take advantage of the actions and the sacrifices of those who step out and step up. If we avoid that planetary ruin, if we find better ways to live, it's going to be because of the courage of those who act. We don't give up because failing to act is actually worse than neutral. It's saying that this climate disruption is no big deal. It's exactly what the fossil fuel corporations, it's exactly what our government right now wants to convey. If we don't respond to the emergency, we become a part of the storm itself. We don't give up because I can't and therefore I don't have to solve the whole problem alone. We're not in this alone. I only have to help where and how I can. You know, there are so many good people in the fight with us, in governments around the world, in businesses, in neighbourhoods, in churches. They are smart, they're experienced, and they're empowered by a vision of a planet redeemed. And I think this is especially true for faith communities like yourselves who are somewhat actioned on this issue. When we look around the earth and we see so many conservative Christians right now who are not yet actioned on the issue, I think we have a responsibility to our brothers and sisters to see that change happen and to speak into those situations. And the last one is we don't give up because despair is actually pretty lonely, whereas action in community, action involves friendship and camaraderie and that community. Taking action is really the only cure for hopelessness in this situation. It feels good, it feels important, it feels like we're not wasting our life because what we are doing is actually contributing to a potential future for us and our children. In Romans 8, the Apostle Paul, he speaks of creation groaning in labour pains. And this groaning and yearning for the future, it's not futile, even though the creation is currently subject to that futility. It's in this inarticulate protest against that very futility that futility is surpassed, because the groaning is the sign of the Spirit's presence. That groaning is a sign of the Spirit's activity, perhaps manifest as profound discontentment with the way things currently are, and then yearning for that liberation of all things. But the Spirit broods over troubled waters of an anxious world and is waiting to bring forth that new life, even if it is new life from the dead. And so for all these reasons and so many more, we don't have the luxury of sitting in our fear and anxiety for too long. We need to name it, and we need to then sit and take action from that place. God is not asking us to pretend that we're not feeling it, but it's to bring our despair and couple it with hope and then continue to relentlessly push forward just in case. There's a woman called Rebecca Solnit. She once wrote that hope is not a lottery ticket that you can sit on the sofa and clutch feeling lucky. It's an axe that you break down the door with in an emergency. Hope's not the act of fantasizing about something wonderful that might happen. It's a survival instinct. Hope doesn't replace despair, it rebels against it. And so, friends, this morning, we know that God's with us in our anxiety. God's with us in our uncertainty. And is with us when our response is grief in this particular instance. We can't actually know what the future holds, but we do know that God is with us in that future. We do know that he's with us. So we have to keep hope, we keep community, and we keep entering into difficult spaces. We keep bearing witness, and we keep actioning together. Isaiah 54 verse 10 says, "Though the mountains be shaken and the hills be removed, yet my unfailing love for you will not be shaken, nor my covenant of peace be removed, said the Lord who has compassion on you." Amen.
Take action. Are there any questions for Alex?
I'll speak loudly. Thanks very much for that. It was really timely and very powerful. And I think, you know, it's a message I think not only we need to hear once, but many, many times. I was particularly taken by your call to action because, you know, and the way that taking action itself can be a healing process as well. I guess the question I have is, what sorts of action do you take in this space?
Yeah, so that's really important, like defining what action is. So that can be, I think it has to be so individual, but there are some things that we can all do. So we can all sign petitions, we can all go to protests. I don't know how many of you have been involved in sort of actions like protests, etc. But it's actually... I probably only started being involved in that in more the refugee space a number of years ago, and it was a place where I suddenly found out that I really encountered God in that space, and felt the presence of God in those spaces. So I encourage you, it can be, if you haven't been to one before or been involved in that, it sounds a bit scary, especially when, you know, some of these guys are getting arrested in outside of... conferences and things, but on the whole, when we're involved in peaceful, non-violent protest, it is, for many people, can be quite a profound encounter moment with God in a way in which that we can worship God as well. So for me, also on the side, so I've been involved in some of the teaching through Riverview. So our pastor, Tim, is actually... He has got quite a passion for creation care. It is quite frustrating, I think, for him trying to turn a church like Riverview towards that. But he actually has done some incredible work probably in the last 3 years on that through a program that he created called Earth Matters. And there's probably been about 600 or 700 people in Riverview who've been through that program now. So I've been a part of teaching that, and... we also have created some just environmental groups, working groups as well. So one particular group, we go out and we partner with organisations who are Canning River, down up at the Boyer Trail, Trillion Trees, etc. And just do really practical things like plant trees and weed waterways, etc. You know, such small little things, and yet... For me, again, and for many members of that group, a way in which we worship God, a way in which we encounter God as well. So I guess there's some of those serving opportunities, perhaps some advocacy opportunities, and then the action opportunities of protest, etc. as well. Yeah.
I think one of the practical things we can do is just simply to reduce our own carbon footprint. Yeah, we can do that. There was something you said, and I said before, that means we're going to be slightly less comfortable. But if we keep doing that and keep doing that, we'll make a real impact and spread the word. But something you said right at the beginning, which if I heard it correctly, my hearing's not great, absolutely summed this up for me. Did you say that people are travelling to New Zealand to see the glaciers before they melt? Am I right in assuming that they don't go there by bicycle?
Good solid point. These aren't necessarily friends who are climate enthusiasts, but they're just aware of, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, it's a really good point that you make, you know, on a gas, an oil and gas rig, you know, when they do the, a friend was telling me that when they do the blow off of the gas or whatever at the end of the day or week or whatever, it pretty much puts out, you know, more carbon than what we would probably utilise in a lifetime. And so sometimes we can be in this position of, well, does it really matter if I stop using plastic or driving less, etc.? But it does matter because it is cumulative. It's us changing our lifestyles. That is an act of worship. It's an act of protest as well, all of those changes that we're making. And finding different ways. I mean, I've been privileged to do a lot of travelling. So this year was the year I went, I'm going to have to stop travelling, I'm going to have to stop using planes. So, but for other people, that's not practical at all. So it's going, what is it that I can do, and responding to that. But all of those things, they make a cumulative effect. We're not going to change the issue, we're not going to solve the problem that way, but it is also a part of our integrity and our worship. Yeah, it's good.
I'm sometimes discouraged by all my efforts since the 70s being, you know, destroyed by one gas flame in the middle of the ocean. Mm. But yep. The other side of it is building resilience, because stuff is going to get harder. Mm. And if the things that you do to reduce your carbon footprint are also things that increase your resilience to what is coming, it's really important. Can you cook meals from basic unprocessed ingredients? Can you mend your clothes? Are you able to invest in good shoes instead of fashion shoes so they're going to see you through? Do you use a front-loading washer so it doesn't wear your stuff out? And it uses less water and blah, blah, blah. All those things are not just conservation. They're building resilience. I see that in health and fitness as well. I'm hopeless at riding a bicycle. I fall off, but I can catch a bus.
Exactly.
And if my government will have the most fuel-efficient buses, well, then maybe I can get about when we don't drive cars. Or maybe I invest in a an electric vehicle, and that's what I use my solar panels for instead of running my clothes
Absolutely.
Dryer, etc. Yeah. But the building of resilience is what is going to be this axe of hope, and it's also what will stop our children falling into despair, because they will not have anything like the lifestyle that we've had.
Absolutely, yep.
And that's before so we even consider the poor of the world, yep. Just looking at our own families.
I love
families.
That connection you've made between hope and resilience. That's, yep. That's absolutely important. Yeah. Yep.
Mine's short and sweet. I used to sit and watch the television and watch Scott Morrison and say some not nice words at all. me the one. And then I sort of thought to myself, well, it's probably not helpful just to, you know, talk at the television and get really frustrated. So I thought maybe I should just pray for him, which I do.
Brilliant.
If we all did, I don't know if it would make a difference, but
absolutely,
know,
that, prayer yeah. repents. I
yeah.
agree.
Yeah,
and even you know, going back to that action, like you know, if hopefully your local MPs are hearing from you guys regularly on a number of issues, and you know, oh, that really annoying person again is talking to me about this, but it does make a difference. You know, they do take those issues to Canberra with them, so it can seem like such a little thing to write that semi-regular email to our MP or whatever, but it's so a part of the whole when we're all doing it. Yeah.
Okay. I can feel coffee calling for me. Are there any other urgent questions that people want to put to Alex at the moment? Yeah, or we can perhaps catch up with you over coffee. You'll hang around, Alex? Yeah, terrific. All right. Everyone, we may just leave the last song, given that it's now 11:02. Or would you like to have the last song? Oh, we need to have... Just, okay. And this is a wonderful one, because... I think this is what it's all about.